From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Do you remember when you first heard the words, "Be sealed with the Holy Spirit"? Those wonderful words of confirmation will soon be heard by third graders instead of high schoolers in the Archdiocese of Denver. Jeanette DeMello and Scott Elmer from the Denver Archdiocese will talk about changing the sacraments to their original order. Also, Dan Burke talks with Father Mike Driscoll, the author of Demons, Deliverance, and Discernment. They'll tell you that dabbling with the dark spiritual world isn't a game. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the Register, and Dan Burke, executive director of the Register. Thanks for joining us. Our first guest, Scott Elmer, is the parish support specialist for the Archdiocese of Denver. Scott's primary responsibility is serving as parish liaison for the implementation of the restored order, which is what he and Jeanette will be talking about today.
Last weekend, Pentecost weekend, Scott, both of us here in Denver, I'm in a Denver parish as well as you, and we're sitting in our parishes and we hear this announcement from Archbishop Aquila, read over the pulpit, that young people are going to be receiving confirmation at a much earlier age, actually before First Holy Communion. It was quite an announcement that happened this weekend in Denver. How did this announcement come to be? How did this fact come about?
Yeah, it definitely was quite an announcement. Archbishop has moved the age of confirmation from what it's normally celebrated at, anywhere between middle school and high school, to down to the third grade. And that's not effective immediately, but that's the plan that we're hoping to get to by 2020. And it came about because when Archbishop was a pastor, it's kind of funny because he was actually in favor of having confirmation at a later age because he really liked the opportunity, you know, to invest in the kids and prepare them with all the knowledge to receive the graces of the sacrament. But then he started to notice that the rite of Christian initiation, which we celebrate at the vigil, has the order of the sacraments as baptism and then confirmation and then First Holy Communion. And so he kind of wondered about the discrepancy. And another thing that kind of struck him was that the Eucharist wasn't the pinnacle of initiation. And so he started digging deep into that and, you know, doing his studies in sacramental theology. And he realized that the order that they had traditionally been celebrated in those sacraments was the baptism first and then confirmation and Eucharist. And so he has decided to restore that original order and make that grace available to kids at a younger age because pastorally, you know, he's concerned about them receiving that grace when they're younger so that they can have more of an opportunity to grow in relationship with each member of the Trinity.
Yeah, it's going to be quite a change, and as you said, it's going to be rolled out in a couple of years. There's some time that parishes will have to help this this change happen, and I'm sure to do a lot of educating to the parishioners in the parish about how it happens. One of the ways the Archbishop is trying to educate the parishioners is through a pastoral letter, and the pastoral letter is called Saints Among Us, the Restored Order of the Sacraments of Initiation. And I thought the Saints Among Us was a very curious title. Why did he choose that title?
Well, you know, he chose it precisely because he hopes that this decision will lead to greater sanctity amongst the faithful. You know, anytime we're making more grace available, it gives us more of an opportunity to participate in the divine life of God, which he's giving us in the sacraments. And, you know, as young people are facing greater challenges at a younger age, they need all these graces. And we hope and we're confident that with the graces of the sacraments at an earlier age, they're going to be able to become saints and live in the world among us.
This is Jeanette DeMello on Register Radio, and I'm speaking to Scott Elmer, and we're talking about the changing of the age of young people receiving confirmation. The Archdiocese of Denver is making a move so that younger people at the age of, really it's 8 or 9, I guess, third grade, will be receiving confirmation before First Holy Communion. It's quite a change, but it's not a new change for Archbishop Aquila. He had this change also in his previous diocese in Fargo. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. He did restore the order in Fargo, and it was a positive experience for him.
And so, what were some of the fruits?
Well, I think the main fruit is what this has, the capability that it has to kind of transform the family. And that's one of the things that the Archbishop gets really excited to talk about is the stories that parents have told him of kids who've received confirmation and First Communion at an earlier age, and how seeing them go through that process and receiving those graces and the gifts of the Holy Spirit has actually converted the parents and strengthened the domestic church. And so one of the huge fruits that we're anticipating and that the Archbishop experienced in Fargo is really the renewal and the revival of the family.
That's great. That would be an excellent change. You know, I was thinking about it over the weekend. It was Pentecost, and of course we reflect on the outpouring of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost, and this announcement was made, and I was just thinking, wow, for the next 5 years or so, because the Archdiocese will be in a moment of transition where some parishes will be offering confirmation at the third grade, and some will be offering it at different ages. I was thinking that's going to be a lot of people being confirmed
right.
during the next few years as we try to catch up to the one, you know, the one time at third grade. That's a lot of grace being poured out in this archdiocese while these, you know, these changes are happening. So I expect that we'll see some major fruit of the Holy Spirit being poured out in this way. So I think it's going to be a great thing. What is the feedback that you've heard?
Well, there's a lot of different feedback, and I think any time that you make a change of this magnitude, there's a lot of very valid and reasonable concerns and questions about the reasons for doing this, how it's going to happen logistically. Most people are excited, you know, and when you break it down theologically and even pastorally, people understand the reasons for it. People, especially parents, you know, when you tell parents that this is about grace, and when you kind of debunk the myth that confirmation is the sacrament of maturity, then they understand that it's a sacrament of growth, and parents always want the best for their kids. So we've had a ton of positive feedback once people realize what the sacrament is as a sacrament of growth. And then, you know, there's always, like I said, very valid concerns about logistics. And how are we going to assist our parishes in making this transition, considering that some of them have, you know, 6,500 to 7,000 families, and some of them have 50 families. So there's a lot of different dynamics that go into making the change logistically. And so some of the feedback is, you know, make sure you don't hang us out to dry and
sure.
that we all have a plan here. So
sure.
we receive a bunch of varied feedback, but overall people are excited about it. People want to know why we're doing it, and people want to make sure that when we do it, we cover all of our bases.
Yeah, it's a huge catechetical moment, I think, in this archdiocese. Now, it's not the first it's the first archdiocese, I believe, but it's not the first diocese to have made
Correct.
The change. There are many other dioceses, I guess a handful of other dioceses in the U.S. that have made the change. Who are they, and who have you been working with as you've been making this change?
Right. You know, Fargo obviously has done it under Archbishop Aquila, the Diocese of Phoenix, Spokane in Washington. There's, I believe, three dioceses in Michigan who have done it, Tyler, Texas. So there's been, I think there's been 10. I can't think of them all off the top of my head here. But, you know, we've definitely been in contact with them to draw upon the resources and the approaches that they've used. And hopefully, you know, because we, like I said, we don't want to repeat any of the mistakes of the past if they can be avoided. So
sure.
we're definitely doing the best that we can to learn from their efforts and, you know, take the best approach moving forward.
The Register's reporter, Peter Jesser Smith, was in touch with the Archdiocese, last week to do a story on this. And the story is called Denver Archdiocese Moves to Restore the Order of the Sacraments. It did really well online, a lot of feedback, and a lot of people viewed the story, read it online. And, you know, one of the things he talked about, he talked to the Diocese of Phoenix, And before the archdiocese, they were the largest diocese to restore the order of the sacrament and of the sacraments. And they said that the catechetical part was, in fact, the most challenging, but the biggest opportunity, because it's a new opportunity to catechize. And really, what happens next? I mean, what happens after these young people in, you know, third grade have made their confirmation and their first Holy Communion? You know, as you mentioned earlier, it's not the graduation from catechesis. It's a different step. So what is the Archdiocese planning to do to engage people beyond this, students, kids, beyond this point?
Well, I think the first thing is that we need to recognize that the opportunity that we have with them in second and third grade is an opportunity that we need to seize to get parental involvement and to involve the entirety of the family. And if we can do that then our next few years will be much easier. And not necessarily easier, they're going to be more fruitful. You know, Phoenix, they took the approach of doing what's called mystagogy. After the sacraments, traditionally Christians take a period of time to delve into the mystery of the life of Jesus Christ, which they've received. And we intend to follow that same path. So we're hoping to develop some materials that will be lectionary-based, so that the kids, you know, coming off of the sacraments of initiation will be able to identify themselves as the people of God, you know, with all the salvation history. And when they hear those readings in Mass and they hear the gospel in Mass, they're going to understand the part that they play in the great story of God and how that's lived out in their lives, so that it's practical. You know, mystagogy needs to be about how I live Christian life, how these graces unfold in a way that helps me build the kingdom. So that's kind of the approach that we have for 4th, 5th, 6th graders immediately following the sacrament.
Yes. That's great, and I know Denver has a great youth ministry program. I think it's ever since World Youth Day, there's really been a stirring in parishes to have strong youth ministry programs. I'm sure that's going to help kids stay engaged even in their teenage years, and it's a great experiment. I'm looking forward to seeing what the fruits are, and obviously we can trust the movement of the Holy Spirit in Archbishop Aquila's heart. We'll pray that great things happen, and thank you, Scott, so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
When we return, is it okay to goof around with the dark spiritual world? What do you think? This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More in a moment.
I'm Brian Patrick, and here at EWTN News Nightly, we're very much aware our world is changing rapidly. The news can be so troubling, but it helps to get it in the context of Catholic teaching. That's why I encourage you to watch EWTN News Nightly and to subscribe to the print edition of the National Catholic Register. Always faithful, in-depth coverage of crucial issues like religious freedom, the sanctity of all human life, traditional marriage, and Pope Francis, his travels, his powerful homilies, and great features like one of my favorites on St. Joseph, Provider and Protector. Subscribe to the print edition of the National Catholic Register and watch EWTN News Nightly, the perfect combination for faithful Catholics who want the news, who want the truth.
For a free 3-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register, or call 800-421-3230 for your 3 free issues.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DiMello and Dan Burke, I'm Tom Price. Our next guest, Father Mike Driscoll, is a priest of the Diocese of Peoria, Illinois. He was ordained in 1992 and is currently serving as chaplain of St. Elizabeth's Medical Center in Ottawa, Illinois. His book on the subject of spirit possession, entitled Demons, Deliverance, and Discernment, is published by Catholic Answers, and he'll be discussing that topic today with Dan Burke.
Father Driscoll, it's great to have you with us. I have an interest in this topic just because of one, I'm a convert and experienced kind of deliverance activity as a young man because of occult issues in my own home. So I have some direct experience, unfortunately, but then also becoming a Catholic, getting a greater understanding of what the spirit world is really all about, if you will, and the fullness of the faith in Catholicism. And so, as you might expect, I've read a stack of books and studied on this topic myself. So I was happy to see your book come out, and I like the tone and approach you've taken. I'm curious, what made you decide to write this book? I mean, there are quite a few out there. What was the driving force behind this?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on. I almost thought you were going to say what possessed me to.
I was going to say that, but I'm just not that, you know, I just couldn't pull it off. So.
Yeah, but I kind of fell into it. I went back to school part-time some years ago to had opportunity to go part-time and get a master's degree in counseling. At that time, I had a couple conversations with a priest, a friend of mine who's in another state, who has a psychology background, and the bishop there had asked him to look at a couple of cases that were cases of possible possession or maybe a psychological problem, and he asked this priest for some help sorting that out. So I had a couple conversations or more maybe on the phone with this priest, this friend of mine. I went on for a PhD in counselor education supervision. What that means is I can now teach the other, you know, people studying to become, you know, masters and doctoral level counselors. But point being, I then decided to do a dissertation on the topic. It was entitled, How Do Catholic Exorcists Distinguish Between Demon Possession and Mental Disorders? So that's how I ended up getting into the topic. It was kind of from the mental health point of view and from this friend of mine.
And Father, what would you, if you were to summarize for us, how do you distinguish between possession and mental disorder? I mean, it's quite an elaborate effort, I know, and it's very unique to each individual, but there are patterns that you've identified.
I think as you'd expect, doing some things you find that are pretty easy, and then a couple, maybe one or two surprises. I've got the rite of exorcism in front of me, and it mentions, and this is interesting, that in the early 1600s, when the rite was promulgated, and it goes back to even earlier than that, it's just there was no printing press, so it was more handed down by writing or verbally before that. But even at that time, they knew that there was this struggle to distinguish between the two. And so the rite of exorcism, again, going back to the early 1600s, says the exorcist ought to ascertain the signs by which a person possessed by can be distinguished from one who is suffering from melancholy or some other illness. In other words, you know, melancholy was a catch-all term for mental illness.
Mental illness, yeah.
Yeah, and then it gives the three signs. Signs of possession are the following. Number one, ability to speak with some facility in a strange tongue or to understand it when spoken. So that seems very straightforward. The trick there would be, how do I know for sure this person didn't know this language? Is it someone who's trying to fool the exorcist? Probably doesn't happen too often, but I wouldn't be surprised if it happens on occasion. What if it's someone who, an older person who knew some Latin when they were younger? Exorcists have to be a little bit careful. How does he know the person doesn't know the language that they've suddenly spouted out here, Greek, Latin, or it could be a modern-day language, you know? So there's one of the signs. Second sign, divulging future and hidden events. That one seems to me to be pretty concrete. If the person who seems to be possessed starts telling the exorcist things about his distant past life, if there's no way this person could know, that would be pretty clear cut. Number three, display of powers beyond the subject's age and natural condition. They usually talk about that being great strength. Occasionally, a couple exorcists say they've seen a levitation. That would be, you know, very obviously possession. The great strength, though, can be tricky, too. I'm a chaplain at a hospital the last few years, and we have a mental health unit. And it's surprising, if you've never seen it, how strong even a small person can seem to be when they are not in the right mind and they are not concerned about hurting themselves or anyone else. It's surprising how many people it can take to control a person in that very sad situation. So you don't want to see that and jump to the conclusion, oh my gosh, they've got a demon in them. Well, no, they might be really having serious mental problems. So those are a couple of the tricky things. You know, some of those signs can be very obvious. Levitation, you know, something, you know, supernatural is going on. Great strength, oh boy, a little tricky there.
And there's a fourth sign in the 1999 rite that's more explicit. What's that about?
Right, and that's more implicit in the old rite. I use the old rite because Yeah, well, the new rite has only now been translated to English and still under approval, and it's been revised. And the exorcists I talked to were all using the old rite in the last, you know, right up until now. So,
and the old rite was the 1614 rite. Is that what you're talking
that's
about?
That's correct. Yeah. And that fourth sign is some kind of negative reaction to the sacred, whether it be reacting to the prayers, to the crucifix, holy water, whatever the case may be, anything sacred. That alone, in my mind, would not be a sign at all. Certainly, with the and the old rite says something about various other indications that, as a whole, pile up the evidence. So that can be one sign, but everyone has seen the movies practically, and so someone who thinks they are possessed may well react to a crucifix or holy water, and so you wouldn't want to go just by the reaction, just by the negative reaction.
That could the power of suggestion could get the.
Sure. So it's one sign, and the exorcists that I have talked to all say that they want more than just any one of the signs alone. I guess, like, again, something hugely dramatic like a levitation, which is rare even amongst possession. Possession is rare enough by itself. Yeah, so that's, and again, that's why the rite has this phrase, when taken together as a whole, pile up the evidence. So the exorcists that I know, you know, that I've talked to treat that carefully, and they want something more than just one sign.
This is Dan Burke with Register Radio, and we're talking with Father Mike Driscoll, who's the author of Demons, Deliverance, and Discernment, published by Catholic Answers, and we'll have a review of that up in the National Catholic Register, ncregister.com, sometime soon. Father, there's a recent phenomenon, I wonder what if you could comment on, we have a post up today by Joan Desmond. The title of the post is Catholic High School Chaplain on Charlie Challenge, Summoning Demons is a Dangerous Game. And Joan, you can find that at ncregister.com. What do you think about this Charlie Challenge? Have you evaluated anything like this before?
Isn't it amazing how the technology has changed things? What time is it here? At 36 hours ago, I had never heard of that. And in the last 36 hours, I've gotten several emails. A couple of people asked me about it, called my goddaughter, and she's a grade school teacher, and she said, oh, yeah, I just heard about it. Just started seeing the kids trying to do that in the last couple of days.
And this is why it happens. In just over 48 hours, there was an estimated 2 million people have used the hashtag CharlieCharlieChallenge. So this is spreading over social media like wildfire.
Right, right, as things unfortunately do these days. It's just nonsense, of course. Yeah. Can a demon really mess with someone through movement of pencils or something? Devil can do all kinds and would stoop, I think, pretty low to ensnare a person. The thing, main question on this one is, how do parents deal with it with their children? Because kids are out playing or doing whatever, especially once they're teens. You know, if you say, don't do that, a devil will, that might egg someone on. So what's the best approach to get them to not do it when they're an age? I would focus on Jesus Christ. I would say, okay, let's think about this now. Jesus died suffering horribly on the cross, at the hands of, the crowd, Herod, Pilate, and Judas. But certainly the devil was involved in that too. So here's the devil who was involved in the horrible sufferings of Christ, and we're going to talk to him like it's some fun kind of game. No, that's offensive to Jesus. Don't do that. So I would kind of try and take that approach. Focus on Jesus and say, you really don't want to be doing that. Make them think about what they're doing there rather than just some goofy thing with pencils. Think, even we're not even going to pretend like we're talking friendly with the devil who's the enemy of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One question I had for you in your book, which I recommend highly, it's very well done.
Oh, thanks very much.
You reflect on current deliverance ministries, if you will. And I was surprised, as it seems you were, that Protestant Pentecostalism has crept into Catholic churches and driven some of this deliverance ministry. However, I have found there's some credibility in one of these organizations, and I wonder what your thoughts are on Unbound. It seems to be endorsed by Archbishop Neistat and Archbishop Lori. And it seems to be a rather tempered approach to deliverance. What are your thoughts about it?
I just quoted you from the rite of exorcism. We don't have a rite of deliverance. There is no deliverance ritual. We don't have a, I'm a Catholic priest. We have deacons. We don't have a ministry called, deliverance minister. So anyone who says that they are deliverance minister, or here is the method, or here are the most powerful prayers for it, for lack of a better phrase, they're making that up. Now, it may be just fine, and a lot of that stuff I think is not opposed to Catholic Church teaching. My problem with it is when those doing it make it seem like their method or their particular prayers that they have found or made up or whatever, and those come from different sources, that those are the more powerful ones, or theirs is the more powerful method. And that's what I kept bumping into in different books on it, people claiming, here's the way to do it. Well, the Church doesn't say anything is the way to do it. It's a good book if you want to read on by Cardinal Sunens, very good book on the topic. And he said, he talked about the Lord's Prayer being the number one prayer of deliverance as far as he was concerned. Certainly you can't go wrong with the Lord's Prayer and the Hail Mary and the Rosary, let's say the St. Michael Prayer, because the Church, those have some weight within the Church. You know, the night prayer from the Liturgy of the Hours on Sunday night talks about protection from the devil. So I would rather go with prayers by saints and liturgical sources rather than someone telling me, gosh, I found this prayer and it's real powerful against demons. I'd prefer to stick with the others. And I'm just leery of, follow this method. This is the most powerful method of deliverance. Well, the Church doesn't say that. So stick with the known things. Stick with the sacramentals. Use the holy water and have a crucifix up and those things.
Father, grateful to have you with us. Thank you for all you're doing for the Church.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on.
Don't forget, you can listen to our show again by going to ncregister.com. Look for the microphone to listen to or download the show. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio. For our producers, Elena Rodriguez and Jeff Burson, Dan, Jeanette, and all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.